Well, welcome to Baltimore. I know you worked here years ago, right?
Yes, and it's really cool to be back.
Yeah. How did you know you were a composer? How did you know you wanted to create sounds?
Music tapped me on the shoulder. As a very young child, I begged my mother for piano lessons. She was a piano teacher. And then around the age of 11, when I had been studying for some 5-6 years, I found that I was incredibly impatient with what practicing meant. You have to play those exercises over and over and over again, and it's boredom times five. And to my surprise, when I got to the works of Chopin, I discovered that here's another person as impatient as I was, I thought, in playing the same thing over and over again. Every time he comes back to vary a thematic statement, it will indeed be varied. Extra doodads in the melody, some interpolated chords, some delays in the rhythm. So in other words, each time he's doing it, he's making it fresh because he wants it that way. And that seemed like a beckoning finger to me. This is the mind of a composer, come and enter this world. And from that point, no turning back.
I find that with Sam Barber, you know, that a rhythm will be slightly different or it'll become in a different line. He's always changing it just slightly, but you have a memory of it, but not quite. So, very cool. And you've taught for quite a while, right?
Yes, for more than 30 years.
Yeah, is that important to share things with young people? I thought an incredibly great discussion yesterday with a group of composers.
What it does is it helps to put yourself in perspective by working with young people at different stages of development, from beginning to extremely advanced. I found that I was most comfortable in university and particularly working with graduate students. It's just where my level of best interchange could take place.
Yeah.
And what they bring is an incredible breadth of experience, but very little synonymous experience. I don't know about you, but for myself, in my own undergrad years, there was core repertoire that everybody had to know. So there was a frame of reference that you could count upon for making an example. And to my surprise, at one of the informal sessions that I added on at Minnesota, where I would provide the pizza, not crab pizza, but just plain old pizza and soft drinks. And we would sit around and talk about a couple of topics that had been announced earlier. One of them, I looked at a recent article that had been in the New Yorker magazine that talked about an eclectic record collector. And he was talking about what's the repertoire that everybody knows, where are the cross overlaps from amongst all the different people who bought records with him. And so I asked the class a question. I said, you know, how many of you are really familiar with Così fan tutte? And a few hands go up. I said, what about Mozart's 40th Symphony? And a few more hands go up. I said, Beethoven's Fifth? What about Rite of Spring? We got a lot of hands for that. And went on through the repertoire that we just assume everybody knows. And then I said, I'm going to pull an example from this article. How many of you know the song I'm So Sexy? And every hand in the class went up. So the question is, where is the overlap of experience? So an example or an illustration in words that a teacher can pull out that's meant to be illuminating for the class members, where is that illustration going to come from? From what musical world? And that gave me greatly to think.
Yeah, gosh. It changes, and I think technology makes a huge difference on our listening. You know, I wonder with attention spans that, you know, immediately we want our computer to work a certain way. And that doesn't translate, I don't think, unfortunately, very well for Gustav Mahler.
There is that. That is, are you content to settle back and listen in the long term? Where this feed, or do you want something that's an immediate gratification, or at least an immediate announcement of what it's going to be? Nowadays, with so many styles out and about, composers really have to encode in the very opening of a piece or a movement something that sets up what the listening frame is meant to be for that movement. So there's all this kind of signaling going on right from the get-go in a piece, and you didn't necessarily have to do that in eras past.
Yeah. How has it been now to just be able to compose? I know you're in.
It's great. It's great. All of us pay our dues in different ways, and working with upcoming generations and composers of great skill and ability who maybe will use music as the central thing in their life or perhaps as something corollary, this is very gratifying in retrospect, but it is a little bit to the side of my main path.
Yeah. I guess let me start up. And are you a pencil and paper sort of person?
I am indeed. I have a stable of calligraphers who are becoming quite adept at deciphering my scrawls. It makes the process of copying a score or extracting parts really a kind of gavotte over time, with some steps that are being invented as we dance. One thing I've discovered is many of the programs that people use, Sibelius or Finale, they want to think for the composer. A lot of the defaults that they set up have got to be wrestled around to be right for the score at hand, particularly if there's graphic notation, dispensing of meter altogether, anything that's an improvisation or a new symbol that one uses. I have a piece from way back that is for piano, keyboard and strings, one player, and among the many symbols that I devised for that are little figures that sit down and stand up that show you when you have to, so to perform the next fragment, you need to be sitting down at the keyboard. You can't be hanging over the innards. You're hard put to find these things in those very popular computer notation programs.
Yeah. You know, I don't think George Crumb would have ever, done a... Had he grown up with a, computer program. And
yes, because we don't think of music that way. I don't believe that composers think of music that way, or at least not all the time. I used to say that for some people, music is akin to the art forms of Giacometti, where there would be a figure where you can see the skeleton, all the little tiny elements that go into it to build the whole are all visible in the final version. And then there are other composers who compose, who conceptualize in a manner more akin to Michelangelo, where they look at the block or they look at the totality, they'll say, I have 11 minutes, this is how it's going to be filled, and then the details come in as the work is begun. And they can pick starting in the middle and working to the end and then back to the front if they so desire, because they have the totality of it in their mind. I think for most of us, we use a combination of those methods, but it's very critical always to have the small and the big picture in hand when a piece is being developed. And that's a hard tease. It's like pulling taffy over 2 months and just one-time pull.
Yeah, oh man. Well, what's being pulled? What have you been, here it is, October 2009. What's the pencil shavings drying on?
I'm in the middle of a work for violin and piano, and after that comes a double quartet for string quartet and saxophone quartet.
Oh, cool.
And then comes a clarinet concertino. And then after that, I'm thinking.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. I know there have also been some wonderful collaborations lately. I've been very enamored with working your husband's art in with your music. And I'd love to know how this came about, and could there be future plans with this sort of thing? Because I think it's brilliant.
Well, thank you very much for that. You bring up a most interesting point, and you emphasize the word future. I would say that the work that we've done on the four art and music videos are a project of the past. This is a completed entity, And it was a collaboration over great stretches of time. Most of my music was written for that project was written quite a bit ago, and Gary's artwork is of the last few years. The idea was to find a way in which there was something synonymous between the two. And to some extent, we've done that. There are other issues that hedge around this business of technology. And for someone who is writing copyrightable anything, words, gestures, music, film, you name it, you step off a precipice if you offer this work for free in a medium like the internet.
Yeah.
And I'm not taking that step just yet.
Yeah, I didn't know if... because it's gorgeous and it's a nice marriage, literally, between the two. I didn't know. All right, cool. I'm here to hear this amazing piano concerto, and I heard the rehearsal yesterday, and looking forward to the premiere tonight. I know you've had a piano concerto in the past that was orchestra and piano.
Yes, and nobody's played that piece, and it's never it's. Actually, the marks aren't in the first movement, just the notes and the rhythms. I never got the articulations and the dynamics. They were in my head. That was something that I needed to do way back in the early 70s. And so that piece is rather suppressed. This is my first echt concerto. And it should be stated, I come to all the large forms much later in life than anyone else. They used to say Brahms was an old man with his first symphony at the age of 40, 45, something like that. He waited. Well, I've waited a little longer. And this has to do with something that is also part of being a composer who's a philosopher, let's say. I think you should wait until you really have something to say in a medium before you address the medium. And so I waited.
Yeah, so there are a few examples, but not tons, of piano and winds, and I think it's a great combination. I mean, when we come down to it, a piano is a percussion instrument, and why not have it in front of the wind ensemble?
Yes, but for me, as a pianist, I think of it as something that sings as well as hammers, and that was part of the dynamic to set up. There are other issues, which is perhaps why there are relatively few examples of this kind of piece. One is that we are, in fact, working with an ensemble missing one kind of sound, the ultra-transparency of strings, the infinite float. You have to deal with breath stream, and you have to deal with what a dynamic, let's say, of piano means to a tuba player as distinct to a cellist. My works that call for that kind of sensitivity that are for mass winds, brass, percussion, are called works for wind orchestra, because I really have orchestrated in the fashion of the French-Russian school, with a high quotient on color and many, many degrees of transparency, as well as asking for walls of sound, which is what wind ensembles can do beautifully and with great power and effect. So that is one of the issues that has perhaps conspired against there being too many of these.
Sure. Tell us a little bit about the title of this. The title is
Concerto for Piano and Wind Orchestra. The subtitle is Solar Traveler. There's a thread that runs through many of my pieces over the decades that really has to do with exploring the effect of contemplating the natural world on the imagination of an artist. There is a lot of wonder there at the marvels that are on display if we can only discover them, uncover them. It doesn't matter if we simply contemplate changes of meteorological aspect over seasons, or whether we are looking at phenomena like the night sky with the auroras, or whether we are considering venturing out into the solar system, which I'm convinced is something humankind has to do sooner or later. Or looking to see what is being uncovered in terms of new species in the deepest ocean trenches. I mean, we don't know our world, and especially if we are city dwellers, we're buttressed from encountering lots of these things that you can ruminate on forever just because they're not part of our daily environment. Well, I like to think about these things and think about their effect upon my sensibilities. And from these come these works that seem to be as if they are programmatic, but in fact are absolute music.
Yeah. Has this been something in moving... you're in Arizona, right?
Yes, I am.
Is this something that adds to inspiration for you to be able to go out and see a blanket of stars that you might not normally see in the city lights?
Oh, we definitely get this. Remember, we're the Grand Canyon State. We have one of the world's great natural wonders right there, as well as many, many others. There are an enormous number of climate zones just in the state of Arizona. And I'm one of those who clips out of the newspaper every week the schedule of when the space station is coming over. And when it traverses the sky during nighttime hours, I am out there watching it go.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
Besides, NASA's continuing to announce new discoveries. The fascination and the call to the imagination of trapped water on the moon and on Mars, which were announcements of the last several weeks. I mean, this is just an enormous thing to contemplate. It could make setting up space habitats off Earth quite a bit easier. And certainly, scientists are among the greatest wanderers in the world. To be a scientist is to want to know. That's the root of the word, I think. And they shake hands with us as artists. We come about it in different ways. We're not as rigorous as they, but we step forward maybe even more boldly than they. And so the world of science calls to the world of art.
Yeah. When you have wonderful suites like Callisto or this concerto and whatnot, do the titles come first? Do they come afterwards?
After.
Yeah.
I didn't know I was doing the Jupiter's Moon suite. I didn't know I was writing Jupiter's Moons until I'd written about two or three movements. What was I doing? And then I thought about it, and that seemed about right.
Yeah. Now, I know you've had some wonderful experiences with Van Cliburn and the San Antonio Piano Competition of having artists, young artists that are very gifted, perform your pieces repeatedly. And this is a concerto that's going to be done by other wind ensembles over the next 6 months or next year.
Other pianists. That's where the idea for this concerto in it is as different as it's being a concerto for piano with wind orchestra behind it. The music needs to live by being handled artistically by many interpreters. The example I always think of is Fleurs-Lys. It's as essential a piece of music when Arthur Rubinstein would play it as it is when the 8-year-old pianist next door would play it, as when it was used in Rosemary's Baby as some kind of sinister little background doodle. It fulfills all those functions and more. The music is larger than any one of those utilities. And so, for me, a concerto needs to be tested by many different artists, by many different, not just conductors, but by many different soloists. And instead of waiting around for that to happen as a natural next step, that test driving has been built into the concept for this piece. It will get 8 premieres in 8 different states by 8 different pianists and 8 different wind orchestras.
Oh, that's great. That's really...
That will be a true test.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. It'll be fun to look. I'm very excited about this first one. It'll be very interesting to compare these 8 and be around and see what happens.
And that is it. A piece of music is larger than any one person's interpretation.
Yeah, yeah. To me, the string quartet is one of those great things that have happened and artistry and whatnot, and has really... Since Haydn, was always sort of a great new music sort of thing that people would experiment and
like
try.
A laboratory,
yeah,
it really
absolutely.
Was.
And nowadays, I really feel Corleano's Third Symphony and Joe Schwantner's great works, that the wind ensemble in some way in the last, I don't know, 50 years or 40 years maybe, has really sort of become that great promoter of new music.
100% truth. The wind world, due to happenstance and due to where it lives, which is in college and conservatory instead of out and in the military,
right?
But not essentially as a freestanding ensemble such as symphony orchestras in different cities. The wind ensemble is the one that understood that they were still in the process of building their core repertoire. And why not reach out and grab this opportunity by the horns? Go out and commission pieces so that they could build the repertory by scratching their own bumps of curiosity. And so we are still assembling central repertoire for wind ensemble, for concert band, for wind orchestra, and all varieties of those. It's an exciting time, and the conductors just love new notes.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we think about the Hilary Hahns and the Janine Janssens and these young artists that come through. The Van Cliburn this year had very young artists, it seemed to me, or maybe I'm just getting older, I don't know. But, you know, there's always some sort of excitement with young people and that idea of prodigies and whatnot. And here is a whole orchestra, or a whole wind orchestra of young people, very open to and being able where they could play Sousa, they won't have that interaction with the composer.
That's right. It seems to make a difference to them. And also to have a hand in the first presentation of a piece. There's trepidation, a feeling of trepidation that goes along with that on their part. They want to know, am I playing this right? Did I interpret the marks on the page the right way? But then there's also this gusto about going into the experience and knowing that they will be able to identify their own imprint on the future of this piece, that they were there at its birth, and that they helped to make it whatever it's going to be. That excitement is very important to retain for the experience of a premiere, and in general, that level of excitement about bringing forward music that's not been presented hundreds of times before, that is central to wind ensemble repertoire. So the kids would have that in hand as more ordinary experience than maybe a player in an orchestra.
Yeah. There, the piece tonight, Music for Prague 1968, I think I talked to Carol or Schirmer, someone that I said it's been performed like 7,000 times, and
yes,
it's one of those hits. And of course, you know, it's surpassed the test of time. It's such a great piece.
It is a great piece.
Are there pieces like that of yours that come out that you don't expect to be like, oh, someone's emailed me that they're going to do the calendar, or, you know, that someone's going to, you know, are there pieces that surprisingly...
What's my Rachmaninoff C-sharp minor?
Well, not in a bad sense, but yes, are there some that just surprisingly show up more than you think?
Yes, is the short answer, and they are not the ones that I would think. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. If a piece has a springboard for coming forward, it's competition repertoire, or if it's taken up required rep by any kind of national or state music organization for passing exams or things like that, then it will get a lot of performances. The things that ring a bell with people, the composer doesn't always know ahead of time. I would like to say a word about a corollary to all of this, which is, where is the bar set insofar as what is difficult from not difficult? The bar for what is difficult, that high bar, keeps adjusting over history. You've mentioned a couple of times my experience at the 2001 Cliburn with a piece that came forward there. That is the third movement also of my piano sonata, that toccata. So It's been played in the context of the sonata, and it's here it's been labeled as a competition piece. Before the end of that competition, I was receiving emails from high schoolers, many of them in the Far East, telling me they wanted the music that they were planning to program the piece next year.
Wow.
So what is a high bar? We've watched this with late Beethoven, both piano and string quartet music. We've watched this with music that's been deemed difficult to understand or interpret, late works by almost any composer. Scriabin keeps springing into my mind. We've watched these become in-your-pocket pieces for people who really connect with them. But the other part of this is the technical ability level keeps rising.
Yeah, it's amazing. 8-year-olds playing Paganini, it just blow my mind.
Exactly.
That rise, it is amazing. I was teasing a performer, I said, you know, pitch has risen over time. I said, tempos are going to rise.
Well, do you have fast blood?
Yeah,
I think there are people that
really
do have fast blood.
Yeah, that could be. So, to me, it's interesting. There are several wind ensemble pieces of late that you've written. I was looking through.
I started writing for this Nature of Ensemble in 2001.
Yeah, and I was curious, is it fun to return to a genre? Is it hard to return to that sort of thing? I mean, obviously, these are individual pieces. But, you know, when you write multiple string quartets, you know, you can try something you didn't try before, say, oh, this worked well, I think I'll, you know. Is it neat to come back and have now a solo piano with wind ensemble or wind orchestra?
The basic question that I think you're asking about is there something in the nature of the ensemble that has potential that remains yet to be tapped? Does the composer understand it that way? And any genre has this. You could say, why in the world is anybody writing piano music now? Or why are people writing songs now? Art songs, pop songs, whatever kind of songs. Haven't we sung all those notes, including every microtone? several times over? And the answer is yes, but it hasn't all yet been done. Or there's an innate fascination with that sound world that just grabs the composer. And there it is. There doesn't need to be. I spoke before about the commonalities of art and science, but thank goodness we don't have to have the rigor of science to say, oh, well, you've tread that path before. You don't need to do that again except to verify the experiment. And I will say, by golly, you need to write that next string quartet because you need to write it.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I am getting old. What was I going to? Darn it! I hate that. I hate it when that happens. What was I going to spin off on that?
About because you do it because you must, or because it beckons to you to be done.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just the imperative comes from the inside, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's really. That's really all the verification that needs.
Yeah. Gosh, well.
And sometimes when they say, cross my palm with silver, that's not as much of a verification as I must do it because this is the thing I've got to do next.
Yeah, that's often the answer I get with asking people how do they know they're composers, because I had to be a composer, you know,
yes.
That sort of thing. You know, it's nothing else is just that sort of thing. You know, I was touting the harm of technology and attention spans and music notation, but I think it's wonderful these days that I could contact you a couple of years ago and say, hey, I'd like to talk, I'm interested in music, you know, we're featuring some stuff, a student wants to get a hold of you, has a question about a part. There is a great way these days to be able to communicate and be able to say, oh, I have X works. I have this work for piano, I have this work for wind ensemble, I have this work for string quartet and saxophone quartet, which, boy, I can't wait to hear that. And so I think there's a great way of technology being able to break down these barriers where Debussy was so blown away of hearing a gamelan, whereas now someone can go to iTunes and get Callisto and be able to hear these sort of things. And I would imagine that's got to be a nice way to get all these requests suddenly for your music.
Yes, requests come in all the time, and I try to answer every email. Just now, for instance, I was in the vocal lit class of Phyllis Brynjolfsson. Somebody was doing a presentation on my music, and they invited me to the class since I happened to be here in Baltimore to Peabody. And she pulled out a score from way long time ago and was talking about it, and she asked me a question about the text and how my treatment of it was, and I answered with another piece that I remembered a little bit better. And she was recommending so much of the repertoire to the students in the class, I simply said, here's my website address, write to me, and I will write back with a recommendation of a piece that's just right for your voice type. And I will follow through. In past years, especially in the past decade, I have been tapped to be composer of the semester or composer of the year or composer of the month at a number of different school districts around the United States. And these were in states far away from where I was living. And the students would do projects, they'd listen to the music and write a paper, or they'd see some video of me playing or something like that. And then they'd write emails to me, and I made it my business to answer every one of them. Any young person who is thinking to connect with someone living in the world who's doing interesting stuff deserves the honor of a reply from that individual. And so I am a pretty good correspondent by email. This is an open door that technology presents that is really an honest and intriguing way for the creative individual to connect with the upcoming generations. You don't have to go through the college classroom. You can do it all on the web.
Yeah, it's amazing, and get all sorts of great information out there, you know. And I guess I'd end with the idea of getting out that idea of being able to find your music on recordings. I mean, I know it's music only grows, as you say, you know, with interpretations and whatnot, but it's got to be nice to have, you know, a recording here and a recording there, and getting, you know, Joanna Polk's recording is delightful. The Naxos stuff, those great songs and pieces are out there. And that has, I imagine, changed over the years, because recording has, I mean, here today we're in a very small setup with digital things, and it's probably gotten a little easier. That's got to be nice to have that sort of thing out there rolling.
Yes, and it lives its own life. It's on its own timeline for how long it will be with us, and people will discover it, and it will be as fresh to the person who discovers it 3 months from now as it was to the person in some other location that met it 3 years previously. I believe in capturing in recorded sound a document of the piece that the composer can verify. I've had on very few occasions, but it has occurred, where I have been present at a performance of a piece of mine that was so different from what I thought I had put on the page that I did not recognize the music. And so that's sort of a spur to at least encourage recordings that will be, in my own view, pretty faithful documents. It doesn't stop other people from playing the music. And this is something that we should say. If we're talking about technology, there is also the concomitant that comes with that, a voracious need for fresh stuff, fresh content. And people who are in the creative arts, if we've been around for a while, we trail behind us a catalog of works that still are, that have the potential to remain alive. They are not dead creatures just because they date from 10 years previously. And so one of the things that recordings does, or can do, is to enable some of that past repertoire to remain very active in the listening. For instance, I received a call last week from a chamber music society in Alabama that had commissioned a piece from me in the early 90s, and they had done it then, and they were bringing it back for the 15th anniversary of the commission, and they have mounted a whole weekend around this particular piano trio. So there are people out there who know that music needs to be made again freshly in the world. Recordings will never take the place of the live performance, but they can be a spur to beckon someone, a performer of the future, to come and pick up that score and make it their own. It's a way to remind you that this repertoire still exists.
To me, it's one of those sort of multi-beauties of music, is that there's the score and there can be a recording, but that live performance too is all, they're all tangible and at the same time not quite, you know, that there's a you know, that you can have a gorgeous score and you can have a very touching recording, but that idea of communicating, and that to me, that's, you sit in your studio and write beautiful music or be looking at the stars and hearing this music, but then there's that process of from being alone and writing it to then the musician learning it and then ultimately the audience enjoying it.
Yes. I discovered early on that although I am trained as a pianist, I don't like performing very much. There are too many things that can go wrong. With all those years of touring, I could count on the fingers of two hands the times I found my own performance satisfactory to me. It has nothing to do with anybody else's assessment of it. I'm the arbiter. And that wasn't a very good percentage. And so one of the things that verifies that I am a composer is I can fuss with the bar until it is exactly right. And once it's done, it's off my desk. Gone. Let somebody else do the fussing on the other end. Bring it back to life from those dots and squiggles on the page.
Yeah. Well, Judith, it's really great to meet you, and I'm a big fan and glad you could sit down and talk with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.